leaky gut is not a root cause. There, I said it. I said it, Amy. The first words out of my mouth this episode. Welcome back. We are going to be talking about leaky gut, obviously, but you need to find the root cause of the leaky gut. Leaky gut is not a root cause in and of itself. We need to stop saying that in the functional medicine world. We're crying out loud. Amy.
Well, I was a little startled by that passion. I was like, whoa, we're jumping right into it.
You were not mentally prepared for that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, leaky gut, again, is something that, like you said, just right out the gate, I think gets a little bit more blamed as a root causal issue. And I think it's more of a diet and lifestyle related issue for most people. Now, again, like the microbiome can play a role to some degree. But yeah, it's wild that it's not discussed as, well, why is the gut leaky? Is more of the important question to ask than the gut's just leaky.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing is that I find in the functional medicine space, at least, it's presented as, okay, say somebody has IBS, right? And they go in, or they have some other condition, and they go in and they get a whole slew of functional medicine testing. And it's like, we're testing for the root causes,
right?
Which is debatable. And then say your leaky gut test comes back positive. It is presented to you as, this is the root cause of why you don't feel good. We just need to heal up your leaky gut. You'll feel better. And it's like, no, it's like what I've said about SIBO for a number of years. You don't just develop SIBO out of nowhere. It's not like your body decided some random Wednesday afternoon that SIBO sounded like a grand time and why the hell not? Let's do it. And the same thing is true of leaky gut. It's not like your gut is sitting there thinking, this sounds really fun. Let's go ahead and just be leaky. Something had to happen to create that environment and create that leaky gut. So if you just stop at the leaky gut thing, you're going to miss a huge, very important part of the picture. And I'll say, I did this myself for a lot of years. Do you remember this about my story? I was convinced that I had leaky gut for years. And I was taking truckloads of glutamine and like Repairvite and all of these nasty things. And I felt better when I was on them and when I was treating the leaky gut. But then I would go off of those leaky gut patcher upper products and I would feel worse because I wasn't addressing the root causes of the damn leaky gut.
Hmm.
So I'm living proof that if you just treat the leaky gut and don't do the other stuff and don't do the root causal stuff, it will come back. Or at least you'll feel poorly.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of nuance that we could have with this conversation too, because, you know, leaky gut does exist. I think that there's people out here that say leaky gut is not
totally
a thing.
We're not deniers.
And I remember something in dietetic school. It was some email that was sent out that was basically trying to deny leaky gut. I'm like, well, it is all over the research. It's not labeled leaky gut. It's more labeled intestinal permeability. If you look at it from a research paper perspective, but it is interesting that some of the conventional providers sort of deny it, or they think of it as, you know, not, and maybe again, like to their credit, maybe they're thinking of it like this isn't the root cause to some degree, but yeah. It comes off maybe more judgy and like, we don't believe it. Maybe their delivery of the message that this is not your issue is probably off.
I think you're right. I was just going to say, I think you're right. I think there's a difference between like, I deny that this exists altogether versus I acknowledge this exists, but treating it wouldn't get us very far anyway. Like, we need to dig deeper and therefore I'm not going to test it or I'm not going to talk about it a lot because I know darn well that treating it isn't going to do a whole lot for you.
Right. Right. And I think it's interesting too, when again, maybe we should talk about and define leaky gut. Maybe we should start there too. I know that we sometimes get way ahead of ourselves and define it 50 minutes in. So yeah. Do you want to give like an overview of leaky gut and then we can dive into everything from there?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the way that I likened it in the mucus episode that we recently did was that you have these barriers or these levels of defense between you and your critters, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got the house, so to speak, and you want to protect whatever's inside that house. And in this case, that's your body. That's, you know, whatever's in your bloodstream, your organs, your brain. You want to protect everything that's in that house. So the first line of defense would be the walls and the doors that are on the outside of the house. And that's kind of the equivalent of the gut lining, like the gut barrier itself. And that's giving you some degree of separation between you and the outside world. Then we've got the mucus barrier, which we talked about, which I usually likened to the picket fence outside of mm-hmm. your yard. And that provides another degree of separation between you and the outside world, or you and your critters, and that protects you even more, with the understanding that maybe you'll have to replace the picket fence every 10 years or so, or you'll have to paint it or do some upkeep, but it's a heck of a lot easier to maintain and upkeep a picket fence than it would be the wall of your damn house, right? So it's like the picket fence takes some hits to protect the house. And then on the other side of that picket fence would be, I don't know, like drug dealers with rabies and bazookas. I don't know, like whatever the bad stuff is on the outside of your property, that's the stuff that you want to keep in check and you want to control how much of that gets into you. But leaky gut, the part that we're talking about right now, would be kind of the equivalent to damage to the outermost part of your house. So if somebody threw a baseball through your window and broke your window, or if somebody came in with like an axe and hacked a big hole in the door, or had the bazooka and blew a big hole in the wall of the house, it's
broke your garage leakiness. Door or something like that.
Yeah, they've breached that inner barrier, and that is allowing stuff from the outside world into your house that you don't really want in your house.
Right. Right.
I could have given a more technical definition, I suppose, but I think I prefer to paint that imagery instead.
You know what's funny is when you're talking, there's some new version of The Walking Dead that's out now. And I was a big Walking Dead fan for a while, and then it just got too like gory and sad for me. Like eventually, like the whole series is gory and sad, but like at some point I met my limit. But that show kind of always reminds me of how a lot of times they'd have like fencing with spikes to kind of keep the zombies out. When you're talking, it reminds me a lot of that. They'll be like in a jail and they have like the jail fence, but then they'll have, you know, these spiky fences that kind of the zombies get stuck in and, you know, can't do anything from there. That's like now my weird morbid thing that I'm thinking of in my head.
Oh, and I'm going to add something to that real quick, by the way.
Okay. Look,
I never watched The Walking Dead, but I will add this. I've seen this cartoon pop up a couple of times on Facebook and Instagram, and I think it's hilarious every time I see it. There's a very easy but not cheap solution to the zombie apocalypse if it does ever come. Okay. You ready for this? You get your little tuchus over to Costco. And you buy like 40 treadmills and you face the treadmill towards your house. So the tread is pointing away from the house and you turn all of the treadmills on.
Oh my God.
And then if the zombies get anywhere near your house, they're just going to go shoop and go flying backwards.
Let's hope we have a generator that can power all those. Yeah. Treadmills, but yes.
Yeah, let's hope in this version of the apocalypse that the grid is still online and you're not getting the electricity bill in this post-apocalyptic world. But yeah, brilliant. Why has no movie thought of this as a solution?
I know. I would love that to be in The Walking Dead. Just coming across some random person that had all these treadmills circling around.
Anyway, back on topic. So, okay, so you could think of the bacteria in your gut, a little bit like the zombies then in that case. You know, there's going to be good and bad, like more rabid and less rabid zombies. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
there's going to be good things out there too that, you know, are out even beyond the fence. They're the good microbes, you know?
Maybe there's a mixture of zombies and good people and like ice cream trucks.
Right. Sweet little puppies.
Yeah. Like there's a mixture of good and bad. But the point is you don't want to let that ecosystem get free, unchecked access to the rest of your body, because then things are surely going to get weird.
Yeah, and I think probably another good point to discuss from an IBS standpoint is that not everyone with IBS has leaky gut. And that's something to really keep in mind, because I think that a lot of people just assume that if they have SIBO or if they have IBS, I have leaky gut.
Yep.
And I think, you know, according to a lot of the research, people with IBS can have immune activation without leaky gut too. So they can have kind of some dysfunction. Maybe, again, they have a thin mucosal barrier and there's like maybe more immune activity going on in the gut, but it might not necessarily be outright permeability. But I think that can kind of escalate for some people into permeability. So again, it is something just to keep in mind that, you know, not everybody with IBS has permeability. And it's interesting because a lot of, I almost think permeability is more highly linked to other medical conditions too, like metabolic disease, you know, diabetes. Like there's tons of research on metabolic endotoxemia and permeability, leaky gut, that drives a lot of kind of inflammatory metabolic conditions. And that seems very heavily linked to leaky gut, where I feel like, again, on the IBS side, I think the more severe cases of IBS can definitely develop into some permeability. But again, not everybody with IBS has leaky gut.
Yeah, and you're touching on the paper that I wanted to pull up, but I wasn't able to find before we started the recording.
Okay.
But there was a paper, it's not that old, it's only a couple years old, but basically they were looking at the incidence of leaky gut across a bunch of different diseases, and they said exactly what you said. They said metabolic disease like type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, hypertension, those sorts of things, abdominal obesity, those sorts of things are very strongly, consistently correlated with leaky gut.
Right.
Then you get into like the what they call organic disease of the gut. So this would be like celiac disease, Crohn's, colitis, that sort of stuff. And those conditions are associated with leaky gut, but funny enough, not as strongly as type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome. Then you get this other kind of layer underneath where the more extreme cases of IBS-D sometimes have leaky gut. It's not always, and it's typically not as severe as the other cases, but there's a hint of that in IBS-D. Mm. And then you get down into, you know, like constipation or IBS-C or bloating without any bowel movement abnormalities, and you get down into these other conditions, and they're really not associated with leaky gut.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're listening to this now, if you're one of these folks with really severe IBS-D and you're having 10 or 12 bowel movements a day, there's some likelihood that you have leaky gut. But if you're shy of that, or if you have constipation symptoms, there's a high likelihood that you don't have leaky gut. And at the bare minimum, I think for everybody listening right now, if you do have leaky gut, that's not to say that that's the primary driver of your symptoms. It could be that leaky gut is a consequence of what else is going on in your body.
Right.
And it's just it's a coincidental finding or incidental finding that we happen to stumble upon, but healing the leaky gut might not do jack for your symptoms. And I see that pretty typically too.
Well, and it's so interesting too, and this might be a little controversial and juicy. Woohoo. But some of the interventions for IBS and SIBO could certainly lead to leaky gut. You know, if you're on these restrictive diets and your nutrition, oh man, I'm getting all the snaps. If you're on these restrictive diets and your nutrition is compromised and you're super stressed and you're depleting your microbiome and you're depleting your mucus lining, like, again, a lot of the interventions, especially the restrictive diets, can certainly lead to more permeability. And again, even some of like the strong antimicrobial type stuff, I think can lead to permeability too. And it's so interesting because a lot of the holistic solution for leaky gut is, hey, go on this really like leaky gut diet or autoimmune diet or some of these, you know, diets that you could eliminate anything that could cause immune reactions within the gut. And again, those things could lead to more permeability. So to me, the gut lining needs fuel. It needs bricks, like you said. It needs doors. It needs to have resources to build up a strong lining. And if you don't have those resources, you're going to be screwed.
Yeah. Well, or at the bare minimum, it's going to be way harder to heal.
Right.
Right? Like, again, if you're trying to build the house back up because it got torn down by zombies, you need the bricks and the wood and the door mm-hmm. and the nails and all of the fuel. Now, I will say this, though, because I know there's going to be somebody listening who's going to try to call bullshit on us, so I'm going to just get ahead of the game right now.
Oh, perfect.
There are studies showing that the low FODMAP diet can help with leaky gut markers, potentially. But here's the thing. I think that it's another one of these scenarios where it's the severity or the degree of like gung-ho-ness that you have and the duration of the treatment and what else you're doing with the treatment. So there's going to be a really big difference, for example, taking somebody who, you know, is severely compromised, really severe symptoms, and nothing else is working. Like there's a difference getting somebody like that on the low FODMAP diet for like 6 weeks and then gradually reintroducing while you're working on other stuff. That scenario is different where they're going to get relief, but they're going to kind of get back on a normal enough diet and they're going to get nutrients again quickly enough that you're not going to get severe malabsorption or malnutrition. Versus the scenario that we see typically, which is somebody who's been on the low FODMAP diet for 6 months or a year or two or three, and they're terrified of food and it's taken over their life and like they can't eat anything. And they've done antimicrobials, and they've done this, and they've done this. And it's, you see what I mean? Like, there are the people who use low FODMAP as a temporary Band-Aid solution, and it really does help them. And it does decrease inflammation markers. It does decrease leaky gut. It can have an antihistamine kind of quality of an effect to it even. But that's not the long-term solution, and that's where a lot of people get this mixed up. And then absolutely, the longer you do these interventions for quote unquote leaky gut or SIBO or whatever, the more of a detriment it's going to be and the worse your leaky gut's going to be in the long run.
Yeah. And it's a good point. Because again, I'm not necessarily against a temporary restrictive diet like low FODMAP or something like that. But another thing about some of the studies that's just come up a lot since I've been looking at FODMAP research, especially in comparison with other interventions for my book, pretty much all FODMAP studies are guided by a dietitian. And so that's the other thing that's so, again, it goes along with what you're saying. When people are left to their own devices, they're on these diets forever. They might not be doing the diets correctly. In terms of getting nutrition, they're not really being monitored. I do feel like there is definitely going to be a difference in the success of low FODMAP if you are being guided by a dietitian, like what's happening in these studies, versus just given a handout or told by your functional doctor to, hey, go on low FODMAP
forever.
And, right, forever, and just live with it. I think that that's another huge factor and leads to what you're talking about, where people are misusing and abusing the diets. But yeah, I think the education is more present in some of these studies, which I think is such a big factor in terms of like the success of the FODMAP intervention in the research compared to out in the real world. I agree. I think there's a time and place, and having the right guidance if you are going to do low FODMAP is important.
Yeah. Well, and to frame it this way too, the first scenario where I painted the picture of somebody who uses low FODMAP as a short-term tool, but with the proper guidance, and they reintroduce as many foods as they can as quickly as they can, right? Somebody who starts reintroduction at 4 to 6 weeks, maybe they get one or two columns of the FODMAP acronym back in, and they just have to avoid like one column.
Right.
You know, that person is at a lower risk of malnutrition because of the diet. It's not going to take over their life as much. They're not going to feel drained and like socially constrained and all of these difficulties that come with following a really restricted diet for a prolonged period of time. So the person who uses it short term, again, the way that the studies are designed, are following Monash's protocols.
Right.
And they're using the diet appropriately. So what you see in low FODMAP research does not necessarily reflect the everyday user experience, particularly if you're going through like a functional doctor or a naturopath or a more functional nutritionist who doesn't have that experience with the Monash kind of way of doing things. So, you know, I think, what would you say? Are we batting close to 100 probably as far as like clients that we see who have done a quote unquote SIBO diet or IBS diet and they come out the other side wicked malnourished? I'm pretty sure.
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be 100.
Maybe not quite 100, but close for
99.
Sure.
99.
Yeah. I mean, and again, I think we're probably seeing more of the severe cases, so that could play into it too. But yeah, I would say restrictive diets have a net negative for pretty much all the people that I work with.
The longer you do them.
And again, like there could be a positive element, but they've far surpassed that. And I think a lot of it is, oh, it was helpful at the beginning, and then it's just the slippery slope. But yeah, I mean, I think from a intestinal permeability standpoint, it's really problematic. And that's something I know we've talked about with my book, looking at specific nutrients. You'd be surprised how many nutrients affect like intestinal barrier function, and like immune function at the gut barrier. There's so many, like pretty much if you look up most of the nutrients, it's like, oh, it plays a role in like the barrier. And it's like, well, shoot. Like if someone is really limited dietarily, we probably don't even know to the extent that what all each micronutrient does to the gut barrier. But what we do know is that most of them play a role to some degree in gut barrier function. So not only if you're malnourished because your calories are low, but you start to kind of get depleted in micronutrients over time, it can cause really big problems. And so again, it's just something that is going to spiral and going to be hard to dig yourself out of. I don't think it's impossible by any means, but you know, some of these diets can definitely dig you into a much bigger hole where you really have to prioritize nutrition in order to get out of the hole.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's the picture that we've painted in recent episodes where somebody will start off in a relatively shallow hole, and then in an effort to get out of the hole, they bust out the shovel and they start digging deeper. And they're not realizing it until they're already way down into the crust of the earth and they don't realize how bad it is until it's pretty damn bad. Mm. But yeah, it's one of the things that I tell my FODMAP Freedom students even is like, Why would a molecule get labeled as a vitamin specifically? Like, why would we not just treat it like for example, choline is a nutrient, but it's not a vitamin? Or, you know, I mean, there are probably others. Creatine is a molecule in the body, but it's not a vitamin. A vitamin means that it's necessary for human health, and we, generally speaking, can't make it on our own, or we can't make enough of it on our own that's doable for us. So, you know, looking at the first part of that definition, it's necessary for human health. That probably loosely translates to every tissue in your body needs it.
Right.
And I think that's including but not limited to the gut. You know, you even look at something like biotin and you think, oh, hair, skin, and nails for biotin, but your gut needs biotin too. Mm-hmm. Or you look at something like niacin actually has some weird research on leaky gut, but it's not to say that this is the special nutrient. Like, don't just run out and buy a niacin supplement. Make sure that you're getting all of the vitamins and minerals, because they're all super important for many of the body parts, not just the gut. And again, this is why we preach on getting you nutritionally replete and getting you off of these restricted diets ASAP. But again, it's like, are you using these tools appropriately and kind of keeping your wits about you, or are you overusing and abusing them? And again, I think too, there's a difference between the person who tries low FODMAP and then they observe that it doesn't help them and then they get off of it, versus the person who does low FODMAP, it doesn't help them, but their provider scares the willikers out of them, says it's going to feed the SIBO. Rah.
Right.
And then they don't eat FODMAPs for 2 years because they're just afraid to do so, or they've been told not to. And similarly with food sensitivity testing or, you know, food elimination diets outside of FODMAP, there's a big difference between somebody saying, hey, I'm going to try to go gluten-free or dairy-free. I'm going to try like a couple of foods, maybe. I'm going to eliminate them, see what happens, and watch my response, versus you get one of these IgG panels. It turns up with 30 different supposed food sensitivities. And then the person is told you can never eat these foods again because they're inflammatory and bad for you. Like the, no.
Right. Yeah, completely. So I think we've talked a bit about nutrition. I don't want to beat it too much to death, but when we do it all the time. So it's a-okay. It's probably good to remind people about. What do you think some of the other big root causal factors are for a leaky gut? Let's talk a little bit about those.
Well, I mean, the biggie is going to be anything that causes dysbiosis, right? Because again, it's to paint this really weird ass picture that we have going now. So we've got the house and you want to protect the house. Then you've got the picket fence and that's going to take some hits. Then, you could think that all of the good guys on the outside of the fence, let's pretend that you have some of the nicest neighbors, like Good Samaritan type neighbors. And when old man Joe walks past your fence, if he sees a hole in the fence, he's just a really nice neighbor and he'll patch it up for you.
Right.
Or like you have old man Bill or whatever, you know, down the road, if he walks his dog past your fence and happens to notice that the paint's a little chipped, he's just carrying a paint bucket and he'll just slap on a little bit of paint for you, right? These are the most amazing neighbors ever, by the way. But you could think of that being your microbes, and the influence that the good bacteria has is that they're helping to patch up that mucus layer and the gut barrier itself, and they're educating the immune system that underlies the gut barrier. So really, it opens this door to anything that causes an imbalance in the microbial ecosystem, whether that be antibiotics, possibly the overuse of herbal antifungals. Again, restricted dieting. We know that dietary diversity and fiber diversity gives you microbial diversity and health and resilience. So if you have an undiverse low fiber diet, either of those factors could cause dysbiosis. Those are the biggies that come to my mind, at least. How about you for you?
Yeah, I think it's such a good point. So, you know, having a healthy microbiome is going to be really imperative for, you know, regulating what's happening like outside the house, and keeping things kind of running smooth. I think a couple other ones that come to mind too are sleep being a really big one. And again, like these are just things that I think help with more of the brick side of things, like more of just kind of intestinal barrier function. Again, sleep seems to disrupt the microbiome as well. But I think, you know, sleep is definitely a big one that's going to affect more permeability if you're not sleeping well. Stress, like some of these other kind of factors, if you're kind of chronically stressed, it's not going to bode well for permeability. I definitely think like movement helps with permeability as well. So like having an active lifestyle, circadian rhythm stuff is definitely helpful.
The movement one's interesting because I think that the research is still evolving on that. There's definitely have been studies that show that exercise, not too much, but not too little, right? Like if you go from sitting on your butt today to running a marathon tomorrow, you're going to have a leaky gut.
Yeah.
Like overtraining will cause leaky gut. But if you, you know, there are studies showing that exercise, when it's done appropriately, helps to repair the gut lining. I would love, and hopefully they'll do the study someday, it would be really interesting to see a study where they look at a group of sedentary adults and compare that to a group of non-sedentary adults or people who actually exercise and see if there's any difference in permeability markers. That would be a really fun study to see.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting because it, you know, just thinking about patients that I've worked with, you're totally right. It is a Goldilocks effect. And part of that makes sense if you think about it. You know, if you're doing really intensive movement, the blood flow is not going to be prioritized to the gut anymore. It's going to be shunted to the limbs, into the muscles that you're working. So let's say you're a runner or like a cyclist. You know, if you're overtraining, it can cause sort of more atrophy in the tissue of the gut because it's not getting as much blood flow. I think, again, what I've read is that some people that are more trained athletes can have like different adaptations that happen. So some, like, they get adaptations in their heat protein. So they might be able to tolerate higher temperatures. Like the gut can tolerate higher temperatures because as you're working out, your temperature's typically going to increase. That's why we sweat.
Hey, your core temperature.
Right. So, you know, I think there could be adaptations, like you said, if you kind of gradually train, but I still think like the people that I've worked with that have been very intensive, weekend warrior types, you know, doing a lot of endurance exercise, I find that it's really hard to get gut symptoms under control when the body's being stressed to that extent.
Well, and I even wonder this. I've seen many people, not all, but many people who exercise super, super intensely to a point where I'm starting to think about overtraining, but they also tend to be like higher stress individuals. And I've gotten the impression from some people that it's part of that idea of like being addicted to your own stress chemistry.
Yeah.
And being literally addicted to stress. And it's like, they're a high stress person and they'll say that they're managing their stress with exercise, but it's like, no, you're just an adrenaline junkie and a cortisol junkie. And you're getting a bump in your stress chemistry doing this really intensive exercise. And you probably just need to like sit on the couch for 1 week and give your body a break.
Yeah.
But it can be really hard to tell people that when they are the avid worker outer and they're overtraining themselves to that extent.
Yeah, I've had a few clients more recently that have fallen into that bracket. And again, I think that it certainly can derail progress. And like I said, I think if you're sedentary, it's probably not great. If you're overtraining, it's not great. Like you said, it's some sort of Goldilocks thing when it comes to permeability.
And it's like that with so much else.
Movement, right? I should say.
Yeah. That's the truth for so much else, right? Like if you don't drink enough water, you're going to get dehydrated and feel like crap. But also if you drink like 5 gallons of water all at once, you could drop dead from that.
Right, right.
So there's a Goldilocks effect for pretty much every intervention, every nutrient, everything that we've ever talked about. I'll even throw this one out. And I don't think that this one is as well researched, but there's little teeny bits and fragments in the research so far. This paper was interesting. Basically, they suggested that eating at weird, peculiar times of day and not having like a rhythm to your eating pattern could also predispose to leaky gut. So the title of this paper, in case anybody wants to look it up, it's "Abnormal Time of Eating Can Predispose to Obesity, Abnormal Food Timing and Predisposition to Weight Gain, Role of Barrier Dysfunction and Microbiota." And this is something too, like your microbiota gets its circadian cues from you and your behavior and your eating in particular. Also like your body temperature and, you know, movement and that sort of thing. But the number one stimulus for the microbiota's circadian rhythm is when you feed them.
Right.
So if you're eating, you know, if some days you're skipping breakfast and then some days you're skipping lunch and some days you eat breakfast at 8 a.m. and some days you're eating breakfast at 11 a.m. And so, you know, if you're all over the map as far as when you're feeding your microbes, that not only causes some degree of dysbiosis or stress on that ecosystem, but also it does appear to lead to some degree of leaky gut, which again, shouldn't surprise us because dysbiosis and leaky gut tend to be BFFs anyhow. But I thought that was a really interesting one too.
Yeah, I agree. I think the circadian rhythm element of it all is very interesting when it comes to permeability. One other thing, again, it's been a while since I've looked at some of these papers, which, again, I find kind of interesting with the holistic space. It's going back to dietary factors. But I know there was at least one bigger study talking about like saturated fat. I know they looked at like coconut oil being something that seemed to drive more permeability.
Yeah, it's more than one study even. That's a pretty well-known thing too.
And more like endotoxemia, kind of like seeping of LPS across the barrier, which is really fascinating because, again, how many people in the SIBO IBS space are like just using coconut oil as like one of their primary oils or kind of overutilizing
it? Or just saturated fat in general.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, that's a really good one. I'm glad you brought that up because it almost slipped my radar. But yes, saturated fat causing leaky gut is a fairly well-established thing at this point. Now, it might be like the conversation with red meat and colon cancer. It might be what you pair that with and the quantity and the balance that matters more.
Right.
Like if you eat red meat by itself or with a starchy bun and no fruits or vegetables, that's a different meal versus if you have like a steak with some broccoli and a salad and, you know, some apple slice or whatever it might be. Or hell, even throw in some french fries for all I care, but eat something green with that steak. Sarah Ballantyne, the paleo mom, she actually had a good article about that topic a number of years ago. But, you know, it could be that if you eat saturated fat, but you pair it with fiber and color and polyphenols, that it's not such a bad thing. But yes, saturated fat in general, including but not limited to coconut oil, is going to perturb leaky gut. But then again, you have people who are trying to starve the SIBO or treat the SIBO, and they start getting really like keto leaning.
Right.
And they start doing, you know, the bulletproof coffee and coconut oil fat bombs and eating large portions of steak or cheese or whatever it might be. And they don't realize, again, it's another metaphor we've used in recent episodes. You're shooting yourself in the foot, but then you're complaining that your foot hurts.
Right.
And you're being a little bit of a silly goose if you're not connecting these dots.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, I think for most people that I've worked with when this has come up where I'm like, whoa, there's like, you're eating a heck of a lot of saturated fat. Typically, again, like I wouldn't even necessarily think, you know, I'm trying to think of how much saturated fat you could buy, like a leaner cut of steak wouldn't have that much saturated fat in it in reality. But if you're using like a ton of coconut oil to put all your vegetables in, like to saute your vegetables in, and you're using coconut oil as like in your smoothies, and you're using a lot of added saturated fat, I think, again, like that's where, to me, usually gets people more into trouble than like, unless someone's, like you said, more keto and they're just blasting tons of saturated fat from natural sources. But I think what typically would get people in more trouble is like doing a lot of butter or coconut oil. And some people, if they're eating more keto, they have to do that. And they're in combination with a lower fiber diet typically. So just like you were saying, it's such a good point. If you're eating a steak and eating it with like a potato and broccoli and you're getting a decent amount of fiber with that meal, like that's going to probably have a totally different effect on your gut than, you know, if you have a steak that has butter on top, you know, cooked in a lot of butter, then you're eating french fries and like not much else on the side. That's, again, going to be way more problematic than the balanced meal.
I feel like this could be such a fun exercise if we could get the logistics right. I almost feel like at this point, nutritional advice could come down to if we gathered 100 rational, normal people and put them in a room and they looked at pictures of the plates of food that you've eaten this week.
Yeah.
Like, would 100 sane, rational people generally think that your diet is extreme or really weird? Or would they be like, oh, yeah, that seems healthy? Right. Oh, like, you start getting into this realm of, like, again, the bulletproof coffee and the fat bombs and like steak with butter and like all of this fat. And most normal, regular, sane people are going to think, like, oh, that's kind of weird. But similarly, if you're like a fruitarian and you're right. not eating any, you know, somebody would also label that as weird or extreme.
Right.
And I feel like that's almost a good barometer at this point, is to say, generally, would a group of sane, rational people think your diet is weird or extreme? But this goes back to an idea that we've talked about before, which is, I think with most any diet, there's a good, appropriate way to use that diet. And then there's like the common way that it's used. So with low FODMAP, the good, the better way to use it is as a temporary thing, elimination for 4 to 6 weeks, then you reintroduce systematically, you're working with a dietitian, making sure you don't have any weird ass deficiencies because of it, and you understand what you're trying to accomplish. But the way it's usually used is your GI or your functional doctor or your naturopath gives you a handout. Maybe they tell you that you're going to feed the SIBO if you eat these things, and then they send you on your way. And those are two different things. Similarly, we've said in the keto episode many moons ago, there is a better way to do keto if you have to do it for legitimate medical reasons. But the way that most people practice what they call keto is nowhere near in line with that. So the person who is eating too much protein, generally I see a pattern with, but also the people who are like not able to put in the time and effort to really cook a lot of fresh foods. And so they get a lot of their calories from keto fat bombs and right. bulletproof coffee. Like, those are cheater pumpkin eater ways of trying to get calories in your body, but without a lot of nutrition behind it. So you can tell yourself you're doing keto and maybe your macros even look like keto, but is that the healthiest, best version of keto to do? But I think that like common man's version of keto is probably what's going to get people in trouble as far as leaky gut goes, because it's these above and beyond reason amounts of saturated fat. And that's going to be a lot for the gut to process.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I agree. It's like, if the more diverse you eat and the more diversity you're having from your like calorie pool, the least this is going to be an issue. Like, this isn't going to be a huge issue for the majority of the people that are eating more balanced. And the more you strive for balance, the less you're going to run into problems like this.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring that one up because I feel like a lot of people are eating fairly high fat and lower fiber.
Well, so, in particular, in this day and age when carbs are demonized and fat is all the rage. And again, like, I'm not saying fat is bad. I'm just saying I would prefer balance versus any of these wild extremes. I think also we could bring in the topic of the vagus nerve and the gut-brain connection.
Yeah,
right.
For
like,
sure.
Vagal projections in the gut are anti-inflammatory, and activating the vagus nerve can not only help with motility and help with secretions and tighten up your sphincters, it also heals leaky gut to some degree or another. So if you have a leaky, inflamed gut, but you've been sucked into the small world and you're not living your life and you have no connections left and you've kind of whittled your life down to something really small, that's going to keep you stuck too. So as we've said in other episodes, sometimes part of this journey is going out and doing things and living your life before you feel like you are ready to do so. And even it could be little baby steps. I'm not saying that you have to book like a cruise with your besties immediately. I'm just saying, like, maybe go out for a 5-minute walk before you feel ready to do so. Or maybe like give your friend a call and chit chat on the phone for 10 minutes before you feel like you're really up to doing that.
Right. For sure. You have to go a bit out of your comfort zone if you feel like you're isolated. And making those first steps, I think, are challenging. But you're right on. I think the more that you can nourish the nervous system, the less you're going to have permeability, or the less that could be impacting permeability. Because I think you're right. So many of our clients do get stuck where they're not really doing much nourishing for their nervous system. And that can have such an impact, like you said, to the gut barrier, the immune function. And so again, it's crucial, and it's something you have to cross the T's and dot the I's. And again, it just makes life enjoyable too. Like it's something too where it's like, okay, your life has become much less enjoyable if you're isolated. So how can you just enjoy a little bit more? Like what, even if it's again, like a 5 minute going and sitting outside, even if you're not walking, like what would make this moment a little bit more enjoyable? If you can lean into some of those moments more, I think you're going to start to nourish your nervous system.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we've presented that to some degree or another in many different episodes, mm-hmm. but I'll take it one step further at the risk of being slightly morbid, perhaps.
Oh, Lord.
We're going there, Amy. We're going there.
Oh, God. I think I know exactly where you're going.
Life is short and weird. And Earth is so unpredictable. She knows. This is like a shtick now.
Yes.
We don't know. We all could be vaporized tomorrow. There could be an alien spaceship on the way right now. Or there could be a meteorite or something. The dinosaurs didn't see it coming. Why would we?
Right.
Well, I mean, I know we have NASA and stuff, but you know what I mean? Like, or on a micro level, you could walk out tomorrow and get hit by a bus. You just don't know. Right. Even if you feel like you could control everything and like, you know, hang on to every little molecule of your health, you can't. Shit's weird. So, you know, I'm not saying live your life like tomorrow's your last day, because then you might do something a little foolish, but there's got to be a teensy bit of that energy, right? Like you want to have like half of the energy of your life with the mentality of today could be my last day on Earth and I've got to make it as enjoyable as I can and like right. live in the moment. But then you also want to be responsible and smart enough to acknowledge, no, there's a likelihood I'm going to live to be like 80 or 90 years
right.
old. So I don't want to totally abuse my body and, you know, get all coked out or do something crazy. Like, you don't want to do that necessarily.
I can't
either.
Wait for someone to like,
oh, the comments are going to
call
be fun
in
on this
or
episode.
Something. Call in, like we have a phone line. Email us to our email that we never answer and say, thank God for this episode. I went out and had a rager of a time
oh, God.
In Vegas.
No, not recommending that. But you know what I mean? Like, so it's, I think people are controlling their health and controlling their life and really like hunkering down, working on this, toiling over this with the hope that it will be better in the future. But again, it's just like the future isn't guaranteed to any of us. So you've got to try to make the most of your life while you can in the moment. So anyway, I think that pulls in the vagus nerve conversation too. Even if you don't believe us, even if you don't think that the vagus nerve matters for leaky gut, I mean, take your glutamine, but also live your life a little bit too, because life is short and weird, people. I don't know what else to say.
I like that. That should be a shirt. Life is short
life
and weird.
Life is short and weird. It is, though.
No, it 100% is. And how many times have we worked with people where they do start kind of coming out of their shell, so to speak, but it's more like their house, like they're entering the world again. And that seems to be a huge part of their progress. I mean, I think that that's a huge aspect for a lot of my clients, is just getting out and about a little bit more. It doesn't have to be anything crazy.
Yeah.
But like just interacting with their life more and engaging more with their life instead of kind of being in their own head or just isolating. And I think the more you can engage, just we see way more progress. It's so interesting. And again, I will say too, the people that are more balanced typically when they come and work with me, where it's like, oh yeah, they're still like, they have a full life. This hasn't really derailed them too much outside of just the quality of life's a little bit worse, you know, with the symptoms, but they're pretty engaged still. Like they're engaged despite their symptoms. Usually those individuals progress much faster. And I think it's because this is not a big issue for them. And I think, again, the people that have sort of pulled back away from their life, again, have to re-engage in order to make progress.
And it's hard. It can feel really scary to do that. Frankly, a lot of people don't believe us when we make this recommendation.
Yeah.
Like, no, I just need the fanciest probiotic. This isn't going to work for me. I'm too special. Yeah. And it does. It works. It can be scary and weird in the beginning. And it feels counterintuitive, because when you don't feel good, you don't want to be around other people. But I assure you it works. I had one other cause of leaky gut that I wanted to briefly mention, by the way. And then let's get into some of what you would do for this. And then we've already decided before we hit record, people, that the testing of leaky gut and the monitoring of it, that's going to be a different episode. So stay tuned for that.
It's going to be like, what about like, should we do solutions in that too? Or like any...
We could. Yeah, we could.
That could be something.
Well, now I feel like I'm a jerk though, because I just promised them some of the treatment in this episode. But
okay, never mind. Sorry, I didn't. I must have like blacked out for a second when when you said that.
You
sorry.
Were so enchanted by me. You weren't paying attention to the words coming out of my mouth. That's all. Yes. Yeah, so, well, so let's we'll see though, because we're trying to keep episodes around an hour these days. So let's see what happens. But I was just going to mention that some medications can cause leaky gut as well. I'm not saying that all medications will. But, you know, things like NSAIDs, so this would be like ibuprofen and painkillers. I believe Tylenol as well, PPIs, which a lot of people are on for reflux purposes, like Prilosec, Nexium, that sort of stuff. Steroids, and maybe not coincidentally, steroids can also give you some dysbiosis and some candida overgrowth because they're basically just suppressing your immune system. I don't know about, you know, on the topic of immune suppression, it wouldn't surprise me if things like biologics or chemotherapy could induce leaky gut. So just kind of keep that in mind, is that anything that affects the gut directly, so like a PPI or an antibiotic, or something that would decrease your healing potential just overall, or decrease your immune functionality, like those things could have a negative impact on the gut lining. And, you know, quite frankly, if you are taking a PPI, there might not be enough glutamine on planet Earth to heal your leaky gut. You might just need to get off the PPI in order to treat that.
Right. Right.
But yes, I thought that was worthwhile of mentioning. But so getting into at least a little bit of the treatment of leaky gut, right, is so we've rattled off the root causes. The first step, if you think that you have leaky gut at all, is to think about the root causes we just talked about and think about what makes the most sense for you, right? Like, do you have leaky gut because of dysbiosis and antibiotic use? Do you have leaky gut because of PPI use and stomach acid suppression? Do you have leaky gut because you've had a restricted, not diverse diet and therefore a restricted, not diverse microbiota? Like, think through these mechanisms, and then that will give you the answer.
Okay. Yeah.
Reverse engineering it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that makes total sense.
Versus what I'll throw out there, because I'm in a number of practitioner forums, and I wax and wane in my enthusiasm for checking those forums. But I've ranted to you about this, I think, that people, functional medicine practitioners, go on there every damn day. And they're asking, what's your best leaky gut protocol? What's your best candida protocol? What's your best SIBO protocol? And it's like, there should be no protocol.
Right.
I mean, maybe you could say, oh, make sure the person's on a probiotic and maybe give them some glutamine.
Right.
You know, like leave it at that. But addressing the root cause of the leaky gut or the root cause of SIBO or the root cause of candida is going to look wildly different from person to person. There should be no protocol. There could be like a checklist of things that you want to evaluate or you want to think about or talk about with them. But, you know, what I actually see in the forums is people will be like, oh, you have to use GI Revive. It's the best product ever. I tried all the other ones. They're not as good.
Right.
And you have to do this one particular probiotic from Orthomolecular because they have the best probiotics. Take my word for it. There's no research saying this, but just take my word for it. This is my favorite probiotic. And then you've got to do the low FODMAP diet because it's like they give you a handful of very specific supplements that they use for literally everybody with leaky gut. And they give you, you know, a food sensitivity test or a GI map or whatever, the name of a couple of tests that you have to do on everybody with leaky gut. And it's the root causes are going to be different from person to person. So I don't think there's really a protocol per se. Amy, what's your leaky gut protocol?
I do not have a leaky gut protocol. But yeah, I think one thing too, just to throw out there, that's along the same lines of what we talked about before, is just assessing for nutritional deficiencies, I think is so huge, especially in our patient populations. Whether that's just starting with like a chronometer, which we've recommended before, or actually running like some labs, like if you're vitamin D deficient, like taking care of that. If you're iron deficient, take care of that. Like I do think there are some fairly common nutrient deficiencies that I see with my clients that could affect permeability as well. So assessing that, I think, could be very valuable for pretty much all of my patients. So if I had like something that I would say everyone probably should do, it would be that. And then again, I think assessing the mechanisms like you described is going to make the most sense in trying to figure out what makes the most sense. And usually people have multiple things. It's not just, you know, they have an antibiotic round. It's maybe that was the big trigger, but then they're really stressed and they, their nutrition's poor. So there's probably a number of aspects too. And that's why it's so hard to do protocols. Because it's like everybody has different factors, and even the people that have the same factors could have totally different solutions that are going to work for them. So, it's just crazy.
Well, and to be quite honest, because I shared at the beginning of this episode that leaky gut was a big thing for me, right?
Yeah.
And a couple of things to keep in mind about this is, A, I spun my wheels for 2 or 3 years chasing the idea of leaky gut. And I think I didn't get anywhere because I wasn't addressing the root causes. Like I said, I was taking glutamine by the fistful. I was taking, you know, some probiotics, some turmeric, whatever. And I was not really looking at my nutrition. I was coming off of 11 years of being a vegetarian. So I think I was really hella B12 and zinc deficient. Looking back now, I know damn well I wasn't getting enough protein, because even now that I do eat meat, I still struggle to get enough protein
right
in my life, let alone when I was a vegetarian. Please. Oh my God. So I think that I had numerous nutritional deficiencies, but you know, I wasn't super open-minded to think about it. I thought, oh, I'm a vegetarian, therefore I'm super healthy and I have a great diet. So there was that. I think I most certainly had dysbiosis, A, just because of my history with like antibiotics, but also because a big part of my journey was doing elimination diets and cutting things out. And really early on in my IBS journey, I cut out gluten, not realizing that I already probably had a fiber deficient diet, and not realizing that wheat was my number one prebiotic source. So I think I actually created some dysbiosis and therefore created some leaky gut when I went gluten-free, because I didn't bring up other prebiotics to compensate for that. I'll tell you right now, I was way more stressed than I realized mentally. Like I was in grad school program. I was away from family on the other coast. I was away from my then boyfriend, now husband. We were in a long distance relationship while we were both in school, and that sucked. Like I lived with a roommate who was moderately to severely insane, and she was crazy ass Carol. I had to deal with that. Like I was in grad school and I had a job on top of that. So I think I was really, really stressed, but I've shared in previous episodes, I'm not exceptionally skilled in assessing my own stress level. Like I just shove it down deep to a point where I'm not consciously aware that I'm stressed. But, you know, I think that it's really not surprising that I spun my wheels for so long, looking at, again, nutritional deficiencies, dysbiosis, stress. It makes sense that I struggled for as long as I did. But I want to also mention now, I don't even know if I had leaky gut, or if I did, I don't know if that was the number one cause of my symptoms.
Yeah.
At the time, this was like, you know, 2009, 2010, 2011 kind of range. I was convinced I had leaky gut because it was the hot, sexy diagnosis. You go to all of the IFM and Datis Karazian seminars in 2010, everybody and their damn brother was talking about leaky gut. and it was cool, and it was hip, and it was fresh, and it was new, and it was the star of the show at the time. Nobody was talking about SIBO. Nobody knew what SIBO was at the time. But leaky gut was all the rage. So right. I got brainwashed into thinking I had leaky gut, and I had blinders on so that the only thing I could see was leaky gut. But I'll tell you right now, I don't think that that was necessarily what was going on with me. And I feel like, I share this because a lot of people still have those leaky gut blinders on because it's still a relatively hot topic. But I think more so, I see this all the damn time with SIBO. SIBO is the hot, sexy diagnosis of the last, 5 or 10 mm-hmm. years. And people come in dead set that they have SIBO. And it's like they can't see anything else other than the world of SIBO.
Right.
And I'm over here in the periphery screaming at them, you don't have SIBO. We need to do other things. So anyway, I think that just knowing that there are trends in nutrition and there are trends in research and hot button diagnoses is really important. Similarly, people were slapped with the label of Candida in the 90s and early 2000s, and that was the hot, sexy diagnosis at the time. So yeah, I'm going to be very curious to see what the hot, sexy diagnosis is going to be coming up that will take over after SIBO has run its course. But I don't know if I had leaky gut, truthfully.
I know. I look back at my journey to the things that I focused in on, and it's like, wow, I had so much confidence in that. But, I think we talked about on the SIBO episode, it's like, based off the fact that I did lactulose breath testing, looking back, did I actually have SIBO? Probably not. It was probably more of a dysbiosis scenario for me, if I had to say so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. Both providers and patients get wrapped up in this, get wrapped up in these diagnoses. And, a lot of times, because they're new too, people, especially the practitioners, are doing things that I don't think are really going to benefit the person long term. And maybe it's because they lack training in certain areas, like nutrition. And maybe it's just that it's new and they're trying to kind of go with the hip thing. But yeah, it's a really big bummer. I hope that we're painting this picture too, that you don't necessarily have leaky gut. But if you do, these are the things to focus in on.
Well, you know what's so funny? I feel like you and I are actually living the functional medicine experience in a way. Right? If you get into functional medicine and you listen to Mark Hyman or the IFM people, they will say, we don't care about the diagnosis the person has. We care about the person who has the diagnosis.
Right.
Right? That's their shtick. And they get all they get airs about it. Yeah, they get all hoity-toity about it. And that's not true. You go into a functional clinic or a naturopathic clinic and you get a holistic evaluation initially, right? They'll do a Dutch test for your hormones. They'll do a GI map for your gut. They'll do a SIBO breath test for your gut. They'll do a leaky gut test. They'll do a big vitamin and mineral panel. They'll do a lot of different testing in the initial intake typically. But the minute anything comes back in the gut and it's nothing else matters. The only thing that matters in the entire universe is that you have SIBO and you have leaky gut. Oh my God, we have to treat it because everything begins in the gut. Every disease begins in the gut. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And they'll quote Hippocrates until they're blue in the face. And it's all of the holistic stuff just goes out the window.
Right.
It's they only care about the functional diagnosis. That's what they should say. Hmm. They don't care about your actual conventional medical diagnosis, but they care very deeply about the functional diagnosis that they give you. But, when I hear this idea of we don't care about the disease that the person has, we care about the person who has the disease, I feel like you and I actually are embodying that. Because here we are, we're like, okay, I don't know if you would agree with this, but I feel like I'm at the point clinically where whether somebody has SIBO or Candida or dysbiosis or dysmotility or delayed stomach emptying or leaky gut or whatever, or hydrogen sulfide overgrowth, I feel like I could help them conquer any of those things using pretty much the same methodology, which is to pay attention to the damn unsexy basics that we talk about every day and look at nutrition and lifestyle and maybe throw in a couple of supplements for shits and giggles. But like, you know, give me a group of 100 people with 100 different diagnoses. If we do the same sort of foundational stuff, I bet that it's going to help at least 99 of them.
Right.
And so even if you do have leaky gut, or even if you do have SIBO, what we're saying is, if you take heed to what we're teaching you and you actually stop and pay attention to and address these unsexy basic foundations, I think it's going to treat whatever ails you.
I agree.
I realize, by the way,
I gave you snaps and claps.
Thank you. Thank you.
I bet Mike's going to be like, no snaps and claps next time.
Okay. There was a great thing that I saw recently, and I don't know if I could quote it now. There's a guy on Instagram, probably TikTok, I don't know, he said he's making up Gen Z sounding slang words, and then gaslighting his students into believing that they're real slang words.
Oh my gosh. They
call him out, they're like, that's not a real slang word. He's like, oh, well, they're saying it in the high, because he's a substitute teacher. And he was like, oh, well, of course you wouldn't know because you're only an eighth grader, but the high school students are saying it a lot. Like,
oh,
you just wouldn't know. I know. It's evil. But he's so good at this. I'm going to text you as soon as we hang up. He came up with so many good slang terms that now I kind of want to use. It's reminding me of, like, stop trying to make fetch happen.
Right.
But they're better than fetch even. He's really quite good. Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of an example though. Now I'm on the spot. Can you talk for 30 seconds? I have to look one up.
Oh my
really
gosh.
Whenever
you put me on the spot, I'm always awkward where it's like, what do I talk about? I don't know. There's not tons to talk about outside of the leaky gut stuff we've been covering. I'm trying to think of some slang terms that I use. I feel like people used to call me Chuggy, but I feel like that's not even a popular slang term anymore. Have you heard Chuggy?
I feel like Chuggy's out.
Yeah, Chuggy's out.
Yeah, I think Chuggy might be out. But okay, so here's one. So when I lived in LA or the LA area, there's the Getty Museum.
Mm-hmm.
I never actually went, but I know I've heard of it. So he was describing this. He's like, so Getty is like this place where a lot of cool stuff, like Rembrandts and stuff, are housed. So if something is good, like if something is fetch, you could say that's Getty. I was like,
oh my God,
that kind of actually works in a really weird way. I'm going to hang up and send these to you immediately because they're so good. But yeah, there's, or like another one he had in that same video was sparse. Like if something's sparse, that's not a good thing. So,
oh my gosh.
Or, another one. If there's a boulder in front of you, that's a really big deal and that's going to be hard to overcome. But if it's like easy, you could say that's pebbles.
Oh my gosh, I love that.
You know, like, oh, you know, how was the test? Oh, it was pebbles.
Love it.
I was like, why is he so good at this?
I know, I could never think of anything like this.
They're so clever. And then the fact that he's conning these students into saying these things. Or again, so he'll say, oh, well, the high schoolers are saying it. Of course you wouldn't get it. You're just an eighth grader.
Oh my gosh.
That's the most evil one. But then there was another video where he was like, he's a substitute teacher and he goes around to different schools. So he'll be like, oh, of course, I'm trying to think of, I don't know, like, so I'm in Holly Springs and then a neighboring town is Fuquay Varina. So he might say, oh, well, of course, well, in Fuquay, these slangs are like all over the place. But of course, like maybe they just haven't hit Holly Springs yet, you know?
Right.
But yeah, it is, he's doing the Lord's
man.
Work.
Oh man, he is.
And we need to support him. Because yes, I think it's perfect.
I like it.
But yeah, I think Chuggy, I think you're a good 5 years behind the record. But look, see, now we could be hip and trendy if we keep up with these new trends that this guy is setting forth. So we just need to follow him and then we'll be hip and cool for the rest of our lives.
Oh my gosh.
We got it. We got it.
I probably am just not going to be hip.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm past hip.
I
think I was past that a while ago, but.
Yeah, I'm hipless.
That's okay. That's all right. Well, hopefully we gave the kids at home something to think about with leaky gut. Like I said, we'll cover testing for leaky gut in another episode because that's like a whole nother can of worms that we're going to get into. But yeah, hopefully you found benefit in this part one of the two-part segment on leaky gut. And we will see you back here, same time, same place, for another rip-roaring episode on the IBS Freedom Podcast. Until then, toodaloo.